Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. Fred and I, a while back, we did our list of scientists doubting Darwin. So much fun. We began with James Tour. Then we got to 100 scientists, then 200, 300, 500. These are all different membership groups. 600, 1,000, then 3,000 scientists by name, then tens of thousands of college professors in the U.S. who, in a major Harvard research project, said intelligent design is a serious scientific alternative to Darwinism. And then over 500,000 U.S. medical doctors, in an incredible survey, said they believe that God was involved in the origin of human life. In that show, we mentioned, and this was an honorable mention because they're not scientists, but U.S. public high school biology teachers, the journal Science published a paper. They were almost in a panic. No, they were in a panic. They asked public high school teachers, do you support Darwinism, the theory of evolution, in class? Do you endorse Darwinism in school as you're teaching biology? 30,000 U.S. public high school biology teachers do not endorse Darwinism in America. 30,000. So as a science radio host, we meet the most fascinating people. I enjoy bringing them to your attention. And so what an honor it is right now from Green Bay, Wisconsin, to speak to a retired biology and chemistry teacher, James Kraft, who will be speaking tonight, tomorrow night, and Friday night in Colorado at different locations. But James Kraft, welcome to Real Science Radio.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, James, I'd love to hear your account as a teacher at a government public school, a high school. But first, I know that you've traveled to speak about creation and evolution. You've gone to Papua New Guinea. You've gone to Kiev in the Ukraine. You've traveled with John MacArthur. You spoke at some of his seminars. Could you give me an account from one of those events that we could begin with?
Oh, sure. You know, I spoke for a week at the Irpin, John MacArthur's Irpin Seminary, just outside of Kiev, Ukraine, and I was pretty concerned about theistic evolution here in the United States, and so I kept referring to theistic evolution in my talks to all these pastors that were coming to the seminary there. And after a while, one of the guys got up and said, "You know, we don't believe here in Russia. We don't believe in any version of evolution. We have seen the damage that evolution has done to our culture over the last 70 years.
Yeah.
And so we don't want any part of evolution, whether it's atheistic or theistic evolution, taught from the pulpit or in our schools."
Yeah, one of our friends, Dr. Jerry Bergman, has written a book, Darwinism, the Universal Acid, How It Destroys Everything It Comes in Contact With. And in the Soviet Union, what a horrific example of that. So thank you for doing that and traveling and sharing the message that God is our creator. What was it like being a public high school teacher and believing in creation?
Well, it was something that concerned my wife more than I, but I wasn't afraid to step out. But of course, you know, when job security is at risk, you know,
you've
got to be a little careful when you've got a family.
Yes.
But I started teaching biology at this particular high school in Green Bay shortly after my conversion to Christianity, and I was pretty gung ho on finding more and more out about real evidence for creation. And so I started teaching a two-model approach to you know, the evolution story.
A two-model approach?
Right, you know, creation and evolution, kind of comparing them side by side, and then letting the kids decide. Of course,
Jim, you have guts. Yeah, Jim, you have guts, and really, you are. That study was done in 2011 and published in the journal Science. So you really are, I would say, of the 30,000 public high school teachers, science teachers, you were one of the more bold ones.
Well, it's been a ride, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But after two or three years of teaching biology, and incidentally, I had the first principal that I had was a former biology teacher, and he was a contributor to the BSCS blue version, which was Molecules to Man.
That's the biological
sciences curriculum study.
Yeah.
Oh, and so he was one of the contributing editors, so he was gung-ho on evolution, and he was just incensed that I would dare question evolution and present any evidence at all for creation. And so after a couple of years of teaching biology, he had pretty much had enough of me and decided to put me into the chemistry classroom instead. And the chemistry teacher at that time became a biology teacher. And I ended up teaching chemistry most of my teaching career. And that was good in a sense because there's so much science in chemistry.
Real empirical science that
really supports creation.
Right,
you know, like
exactly.
The first and second law of thermodynamics, for example.
Well, if this we'll have to get to that topic. Let's not forget that first and second laws of thermodynamics. But if this principal who co-authored this text for BSCS, if he co-authored this Molecules to Man evolution text, he had zero evidence for molecules to anything evolution. I mean, a biogenesis, this study on the origin of life from a materialist perspective, that study has stalled. There's very, very little money available to it. And it's in crisis. Obviously, he had no evidence for that. Sorry, I interrupted you just when you said that you offered the kids two models. And so I'm wondering, how did that work in the classroom? Were the students comfortable sharing their own ideas? Just if you could give us some insight on that.
Yeah, I think some of the students were. Some of them were, I think, had come to a point where they were pretty much evolutionists at that, you know, at that stage. Because, you know, the kids, by the time they're in kindergarten, they're learning that dinosaurs evolved millions and millions of years ago. And so they've come to accept it as real solid science. So, you know, there were some kids that really felt that I was being unscientific in questioning the age of the dinosaurs, for example. We would talk about the age of the Earth, you know, the 10,000-year young Earth position versus the 4.5 billion year position, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, so we discussed a lot of different. There's so many topics involved in the evolution issue, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of places where you can compare the two side by side.
Yeah.
You know, and I enjoy doing that
because
it really like, for example, with time, it really points out, you know, the whole. Why time is so incredibly important, you know, when you're talking about this issue.
Whether it's billions of years
is time,
or thousands.
You know, did things happen immediately or did they happen over long periods of time?
Right.
Were the 6 days, I think the 6 days were very important because it's sort of like a mousetrap, you know, the irreducible complexity thing. You try to put something together over millions, billions of years, and you don't have all the supporting characters. You know, the ecosystems all working together as a unit.
Wow.
You know, you've got one animal trying to survive,
right.
You know, without a food source or without the sun, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So you got to have the whole package there at once. So
at DU,
there's a lot of aspects to time.
Jim, at
that,
DU,
you know,
here
we can talk about.
At DU here in Denver, the University of Denver, there was a debate, creation evolution. And after the debate, we have a little video. It's on our YouTube channel. this evolutionist said to me, "So, will you agree that if the first organism appears on Earth, then Darwinism could explain all the rest?" And I said, "Are you kidding me with the necessity of a robust ecosystem where different mm-hmm. organisms provide biological services to other organisms in redundant fashion? When there's a single species that goes extinct, that's like a crisis. And you're telling me that one species is going to survive all by itself. It's ridiculous."
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So timing has to do with, you know, all these things appearing as a synchronous unit as opposed to spread out over millions.
What a great point. Let me let the audience know that you'll be speaking in Colorado this evening in Sterling, tomorrow evening in Fort Morgan, and Friday night in Denver, Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship, and then Colorado Springs, 1 in the afternoon. We'll give the details, the locations, later in this interview. But could we talk about forensic faith? I love that term that you use. We're speaking with James Kraft, who's a retired biology and chemistry teacher from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Jim, you talk about forensic faith, and we have an article on our website on forensics and how that informs a Christian's belief, even in a biblical concept. So when I saw that you used the term forensic faith, I really love that. Can you describe that?
Yeah, forensic faith is using evidence to support your faith. In other words, the apostles saw probably thousands of miracles that Christ did.
Mm.
Thousands. Christ didn't just say, "I want you to believe in me."
No, right.
And you look at all the people that were in Israel at that time. They were going gaga over Jesus Christ. He was a rock star. I mean, he was drawing attention literally. I mean, they heard about him in Rome and all over the place. So he didn't ask people, "Just believe in me." You know, he gave them an incredible amount of reasons to believe in him. And so when the resurrection finally happened, they said, "Wow, now we really believe in him," you know.
Yes, and I love that you mentioned that, because not all Christians recognize the importance of it. They talk about faith almost as though it's blind faith, like an atheist who believes that life arose from a rock. That's blind faith. But the New Testament says that faith is the evidence of things not seen, and that's in the epistle to the Hebrews. And Paul wrote to the Romans that since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, and we should presuppose the existence of God, because without God, nothing is intelligible. But the Bible goes out of its way extensively to use evidence for people to trust in Christ.
Right, right. Now, you know, Bob, there's another faith that you didn't mention. That's unreasonable faith.
Mm.
And I believe that the evolutionist has unreasonable faith, as well as blind faith. In other words, the evidence points against evolution, and yet they still believe it.
Wow.
Blind faith is not having any evidence for or against. And I talk to kids, you know, in the high school setting, you know, I talk to kids, you know, and they'll say, "Well, you know, Mr. Kraft, I don't need all this evidence that you're giving us for creation. I believe it because the Bible said so."
Mm.
You know, and that's great, except these kids are totally naive. They have no idea what's coming up against them when they go to college.
Right, right.
And they're thrown into a lecture hall with 1,000 other kids, and you know, and they got this professor up there who's an atheist, and he wants to belittle Christianity, he wants to belittle creation, you know, and these kids are afraid to speak up, obviously, like many of us would be, and in that setting,
mm-hmm.
and so they gradually are kowtowed into, you know, saying, well, I guess this guy must be right because he's got this PhD and, you know, and I'm just a freshman.
Right. They end up losing their faith. So many kids who grew up in church anyway, who go to public school, go to college, they lose their faith. And when a teenager says, well, Mr. Kraft, I don't need to learn that evidence because I believe kids have a million ways of explaining why they don't have to study something, why they shouldn't actually spend time learning, and it's just an excuse. And the Bible doesn't support that excuse because God puts throughout the scriptures that he is the creator, and he tells us to share with others that he is the creator and look at the evidence for things not seen. So God is invisible to us. We can't see him, but the evidence is everywhere that he is the creator, and faith is the proper response to the evidence for things not seen.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow. Yeah. So forget about unreasonable faith. We should expose that.
Right. And, you know, Charles Templeton was a very, very bright guy, contemporary of Billy Graham back in the 50s, and he lost his faith, you know, because evolution. You know, he went to, I don't know if it was Harvard or MIT, you know, MIT or one of those schools for some extra coursework, and he got introduced to evolution, and he never looked back. So even really smart adults can lose their faith over this topic. It's not just high school and college kids.
Well, Jim, this Friday we're going to have a biochemist on the show to talk about life arising from chemicals, a biogenesis. And he's going to help the audience understand how absurd that is and how that's an example of unreasonable faith. But let me let the audience know, Fred Williams and I began a series last week on the problems with star formation, and that series will be continued in a couple weeks from now. And so just to let the audience know a bit of programming information there. But this Friday, we're going to talk about a biogenesis and the incredible evidence against the unreasonable faith that life could just arise from chemicals.
Yeah. Is that James Tour?
Well, no, I wish it was. We've never had James Tour on the show, but this is Dan Reynolds. He's out of the Research Triangle area of North Carolina.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Hey, one of the things that I do with little kids and high school kids is I have them put together a clothespin. And I just, three-piece wooden clothespin. And I tell them that those three pieces represent the three components to everything in the universe, and that's matter, energy, and information. And of course, the most important of those three is information.
Yes.
And then I say, I want you to study this clothespin because I'm going to ask you to take it apart and then reassemble it with the information that you've learned from looking at it. While they're doing that, I take those three pieces, put it in a coffee can and shake them up, you know, and I say, now, okay, you know, I do that for, you know, five minutes.
Do it for 12 million years.
Say, what do you think? Think those three pieces are put together? And after they have reassembled one of these clothespins and they struggle with it, they realize, man, if you can't put a clothespin together, how is life going to come together?
Wow.
But I always like to use something really, really simple like that to totally blow away the idea that it could have happened, you know, that's billions of years.
That is just awesome, Jim. It's a manufactured item, just like a hydrogen atom, just like a living cell, the DNA molecule. Right. These things are manufactured items. And when you talk about the elements on the periodic table, they are manufactured items to the ultimate precision. Like, there is no difference between atoms of the same isotope. They're identical. And that's really astounding. The Big Bang model doesn't explain why all these items would be precise and identical. And I think it's thrilling that they are.
Well, we live in a universe, don't we? Which means that, you know, that the items, you know, the elements and the processes, the laws are uniform throughout the entire universe, or at least we believe that.
Yes.
Now, you know, and we run science on that presupposition that that all these things are the same.
And one foundation of that, you mentioned the first and second laws of thermodynamics. We haven't talked about this in quite some time on this program. So I think you'll be mentioning this Friday night with Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. Could you give us a quick insight into the laws of thermodynamics?
I'll give you the short course here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the first law says that matter and energy cannot be created or destroyed. And, you know, it's interesting that in the 19th century, a lot of scientists became atheists because of that law. They said, well, if matter can't be created, then obviously there can't be a creator. In other words, well, if it can't be created, then God doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, but that that law is confused. A natural law that applies only to matter that God has created.
So
the fact that matter exists tells us that there must have been a creator.
Yeah, so often an atheist will take the physical laws and apply them to a spiritual creator and say, see, I disproved your creator. And it's as though they don't understand that they're trying to refute Christianity, so they have to apply themselves to the Christian faith. And in the Christian faith, God is not a very old man who has a physical body. He's the eternal spiritual God, creator. And so, no, the laws of physics don't apply to our spiritual God.
Right, right. Now, have you done much on Kurt Gödel and the incompleteness theorem?
No, we haven't. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Kurt Gödel proved mathematically that there are some things that you cannot prove, that science will never prove. They are presuppositions, and he started with, I guess there's five things in geometry that cannot be proven. You know, we recognize logically that they, you know, like a straight line will continue forever, things like that. Now, I'm not much of a geometrist, but
we have axioms that we take as self-evident.
Right, right. And so what he did was he started with a bicycle, and he said, now, the origin of a bicycle does not lie within the bicycle. It lies outside the bicycle. And that would be, of course, the bicycle factory. So then he said, well, let's go to the factory. So where did the factory come from? Well, that didn't come from what's in the factory. That came from inventors and builders and bankers and investors and all these workers and all these people putting the bicycles together. Well, now, so where did all those people come from? Well, now, the circle keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Eventually, you end up drawing a circle around the entire universe. So now you got to ask the question, okay, where did the universe come from? Well, it obviously came from something outside of the universe. And that, of course, would be would be God.
And that is rational.
In other words, he's transcendent.
Yes, right.
In time, matter, space, he is transcendent.
Yes, the transcendent argument for the existence of God, which for our audience might remember, some who've been around a while, we had our battle royale against Zaketh, an atheist psychologist, years ago. And, of course, we introduced the transcendent argument for the existence of God. So there are axioms that you can't prove, but you take them as self-evident.
Right, right.
Could you?
Exactly.
So that we were talking about thermodynamics, matter nor energy could be created nor destroyed. The first law, they could be transferred from energy to matter, or matter to energy equals MC squared. The second law is the increase in entropy. In other words, things wear down. The universe is wearing down.
Order to disorder, from hot to cold.
Right.
From high information to low information. There are so many aspects to the second law of thermodynamics. Originally, it referred to heat, and that was developed. That second law was developed during the age of the steam engines, and they realized that as things got colder, they had less energy in them. They could do less work. They were less useful. You know, and so everything went from hot to cold, not cold to hot. And so the idea is that, you know, God wound up the God wound things up. He wound up the clock, so to speak, and it's been running down ever since. And that applies to evolution. I mean, it applies to, you know, our genome running down, mutations. It applies to us getting old and eventually dying. It applies to information in a book that is blown up and it doesn't reassemble into new information.
Right. The universe itself, and you mentioned, but the universe itself is at a low entropy state right now. It obviously in the past had even lower entropy. And so the atheist evolutionist has a very hard time dealing with the information content in a living cell. Where does that come from? If there's, in fact, you can't really convert heat entropy into information entropy, but I think you implied that there is a relationship there. The concept goes far beyond just thermodynamics.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So
yeah, they're all related.
We're about out of time. Let's talk about the places you're going to speak so that people could show up in person. Sterling, Colorado, tonight at the First English Lutheran Church. Do you know what time that starts?
That starts at 7.
All right, 7 o'clock. And then tomorrow night, which is Thursday, March 12th, that's in Fort Morgan here in Colorado. Tomorrow night, that's March 12th at 7 o'clock at the Calvary University Innovation Center. So you could Google that, find that address. Then Denver, you're going to speak at our Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. That's awesome that you've come in for these events, Jim. And that's at the Littleton Baptist Church, also beginning at 7 o'clock. And then your only event that's in the afternoon, that's down in Colorado Springs?
Right. That's at the Mesa Hills Bible Church.
Okay.
In Colorado Springs.
Mesa Hills Bible Church at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Hey, this is Dominic Enyart, Bob's son. I'm butting in post-production. Just a quick update. It is 1 o'clock on Saturday at Mesa Hills, not on Friday.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
That's just awesome. So, Jim, it's an honor that you joined us today for this special edition of Real Science Radio so we can let people know about your speaking engagements. And thanks for coming to Colorado.
Well, thank you, Bob. Thank you. I'm enjoying the weather here.
Okay, that's super. So that is James Kraft, retired biology and chemistry teacher from Green Bay, Wisconsin. And yeah, he's one of the 30,000 U.S. public high school science teachers who did not endorse, he's retired now, but who did not endorse Darwinism in class. Wow, it's really astounding with all the onslaught of the propaganda, how many people speak against evolution. Our telethon this month, March 2020, our goal is $40,000. If you could possibly help, the person who just signed up for a subscription, he said, don't say my name on the air, just keep sharing the truth. So that was so kind. Our website, kgov.com. May God bless you.
Scholars can't explain it all away.